Hey, Smetters.
Hey there, all you cool cats and kittens.
Nice one. Right. So,
how was your week?
So great. How was your week?
Not bad. Wasn't very eventful, really. When's the last time we did it? Last Saturday? So, it was after Thanksgiving, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, Saturday, but... So I guess the biggest thing that's happened since last time we talked to everybody, kind of Black Friday was over with, but Cyber Monday happened. So I guess that was the biggest exciting thing.
So much fun. Well, we had something kind of funny happen tonight that I've never seen before.
Okay.
So tonight was like our cheat night when we get to eat whatever, you know? And we went and got Hispanic food.
Mexican food. It's not wrong to say Mexican.
It's not?
No, that's not politically incorrect.
Okay. I just don't, you know, I just want to make sure I'm right. So we went and got Mexican food, and usually I call and order it, but tonight I was like, I'm going to do the order online thing because they use like a third party order online thing. So our little girl was like, oh, I want these tacos. And I was like, okay. So I clicked on it and it said, what kind of meat do you want? And it gave me a list of choices. And it was like ground beef, chicken, steak, donkey.
Oh, yeah. Donkey.
I was like, what the hell? And I really wanted to order the donkey just to see like if it would be like, just kidding. But like, I was very surprised. But she got her tacos and she's like, these are really good. And I was like, well, good, because I got you the donkey meat instead.
It reminded me of Dwight Schrute on The Office talking about you always eating pony and stuff like that.
I was just not expecting it. I was... So, yes, it literally had donkey on the menu, and I don't know if that's a thing that people eat. I've never eaten donkey or even heard of donkey being eaten, but...
I've never heard of it either, and if it's a delicacy or if that's something common outside of the South, I guess, please let us know, but I'm not going to try donkey, because I think of Shrek.
That's a nice boulder.
My boulder.
But yeah, it kind of made me laugh. I was in shock for a while. I even screenshot it because I'd never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, we need to post that and ask if because I need more information. I can't go off of like not knowing. That, you know?
Okay, so we will post it and
I'll troglodyte it here in a few.
All right, well, we had a young lady request that we do the Villisca Axe Murders.
Since we messed it up.
Well, the first time, we're redoing the Villisca Axe Murders, y'all, because if you've been with us from the beginning, we did it for our second episode.
Back when our audio was amazing.
Yes, and I deleted it because it was so bad, and... I think that episode was 10 minutes long. So this one is a lot longer than 10 minutes, y'all. It is very good. I've just found out that they have a new suspect to the murder because the murder is unsolved, obviously. And we've got a lot of paranormal stuff going on. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the whole murder. We're going to go through the suspects. There's two main suspects we're going to concentrate on. And then after that, we will go over the paranormal activity. And then I've got a question about that when we get there. So since it is kind of a long one, let's go ahead and dive on in. To the Villisca Axe Murder. So,
wait, you said this one's going to be a long one? That's what she said.
That's why I hurried. I was like, he's going to say.
Literally, yeah, guys, real quick. Literally, like, you know, I heard it's kind of a thing, too, for people with high anxiety and this, that, and the other. They will watch a show or a movie like continuously, and I don't know that I have really high anxiety or not, but for, you know, I do enjoy it and I do watch it a lot, but just for, you know, background noise, making sure we eat dinner or when we're eating dinner, and actually since Jennifer and I have been married, she is one that has to sleep with the TV on. I've never ever been that way. It actually, well, I probably couldn't sleep for almost the first 2 years of our marriage, but I learned to deal with it. And so I have discovered that I can't watch any cartoons like Family Guy or American Dad or anything like that when we go to bed at night, because it literally, like, any, like, okay, like Steve on American Dad, he's a little whiny bitch. He like screams and it wakes me up. And kind of with Family Guy, there's like some exciting scenes where everything gets real loud. So so I went back to Old Faithful, which is The Office. Mm-hmm. And so literally The Office is playing almost 24/7 in our house until it's time for Jennifer and I to watch something like a movie together. But so yeah, if you hear me with these Office references or say something about it,
so
that's why, because I literally know every line of The Office. So,
which,
anyways, I didn't mean to interrupt or take over. I just wanted them to be aware of that.
Well, I think it's also a compromise because, y'all, I could watch cartoons all day, every day. And Troy is so funny. He's like, can we watch something that doesn't have a lot of blood and that is not a cartoon? Because those are my two go-tos, like violence, bloody, and then cartoons. And I used to...
Okay, I don't mind horror, scary movies.
I know, but that's like, all I watch.
But the deal with it, like, modern-day scary movies, really, you know, like, Possession and
yeah,
little kids and Emily Rose being all contorted and stuff, that... I'd rather not watch that as I'm going to sleep. Call me crazy, but I just don't. But, you know, I do enjoy horror movies, so don't think that.
No, I'm saying we've compromised at bedtime because, you know, as I said, I could watch cartoons all the time. I just love cartoons. And I don't think my mind's developed past a certain age since like 5 or something.
I told you that our entire...
I feel like you're right because like I said, I am obsessed with cartoons. And, but yeah, so we compromised on The Office and I love The Office. I think it's hilarious, especially the Superfan episodes.
Oh yeah. On Peacock, there's two versions. And actually I think Peacock has learned our behavior because once one of them gets done, whether it's the Superfans episode or all seasons at the very last one, it automatically kicks on the next one and it just keeps going. So it's on a loop.
It really is. They're going to ban us from watching it, I think. But
anyway, sorry about that.
Sponsor us, Peacock. Anyway, so yes, we're going to jump into this real quick because it is going to take a while. Now, I'm going to go over the people involved. We have Josiah B. Moore, who is the dad. He is 43. We have Sarah Moore, who is 39. That is the mom. Then we have Herman, who is 11. We have Catherine, who is 10. Boyd, who is 7. Paul, who is 5. Lena, who is 12. And Anna Mae, who is 8. So those are the main people in the story. So, my notes are crazy everywhere.
Where did this take place in the United States?
Yes, this took place, and I'll go over that in just a sec. Okay, our story starts in Villisca, Iowa, on June 9th, 1912. Villisca was known to be a safe town. It was a dry county, and no one locked their doors. Now, the night these murders happened, I did find out that all the city lights, like the street lights, were out. Which this was an actual coincidence, but it turns out the Villisca Town Council for months had been in dispute with the Villisca Public Service Company. It involved better lighting and replacement of light poles for the business district. The bickery went on all the way to district court, so the power company got super pissed off and cut all the city lots the night of the murders. They were then turned on the very next day. Now, I know what you're thinking, like, could somebody have been involved in the murder at the light company for them to turn all the lights off in the city just for that night? Absolutely not. This is just a coincidence. It's a terrible coincidence that this happened because, you know, I feel like, you know, when the power goes out, like after a bad storm and you're sitting there at nighttime in the dark and nothing's on,
mm-hmm.
and it's so quiet and everything's so still. It's almost creepy when that happens, you know?
I don't know. Yeah. But there is something calming about complete silence too. Like if you go outside, you know, you hear.
Yeah. For sure.
Nature, you know, the bugs and crickets. After it's rained and stormed, you can hear everything. It's kind of calming. Kind of like when it snows. Everything's just so quiet.
It's very quiet, yeah. It's muffled. But you don't realize all the sounds you have going on in your home, like the air conditioning unit, the heating, you know, the buzzing of lights maybe. I mean, you just don't realize it. So, now, I just wanted to let y'all know that that had also happened that night, but it was just a coincidence that they had no part in it. After midnight on June 10th, a killer went in a farmhouse through an unlocked door. He had been outside, but while he was, he noticed there was an axe in the shed. He grabbed it. While inside, he put a lantern under a piece of furniture. Then he got started. He walked past the downstairs bedroom where two little girls were fast asleep. He walked upstairs to the second floor to the master bedroom, where he would find Josiah B. Moore and Sarah Moore asleep in their bed. He then raised the axe and brought it down on both their heads and faces. The next morning, the Moore's neighbor, Mary Peckham, who was like a grandmother figure to the children, and she adored this family, y'all. This was her second family. She starts all of her chores and notices the Moores aren't up yet. She notices all the curtains are closed, too. Usually, the family was up tending to their farm. They took very good care of their animals. They were very well liked in the town. Josiah was one of Villisca's most prominent businessmen. Sarah was a very active member of the Presbyterian Church, was very active with the children in the church, and led the Children's Day exercises on June 9th. Herman, the oldest of the children, was 11 years old. He was his father's little shadow, and he was always seen by his side, which I think that's so cute.
Mm-hmm.
Daddy's little man.
Well, Ashlyn used to be that way towards me.
Well,
she's little.
Yeah. Catherine, who was 10 years old, was good friends with the Stillinger sisters, Lena and Ina May. It was her request that they stay the night on June 9th. Boyd and Paul were the youngest children, 7 and 5. Little is known about them. So usually, as I was saying, the Moores were up by now. Mary knew something was off and even said she felt an odd stillness. She knocked on the door. She even tried to go in, but for some reason, all the doors were locked, which again is very strange for this time period. Most people didn't lock their doors back then. So Mary decided that since they weren't up yet, she was going to do the chores for them. She took care of all the animals, got them watered and all that good stuff. She got all the chores done around the farm. But the more time that went by, Mary couldn't shake the bad feeling she had. Now, the Stillinger sisters had stayed the night with the Moores. Their parents were getting a little concerned because they hadn't heard anything from the girls yet. Sarah Stillinger, the girl's mom, called to figure out when they would meet. But no one answered the phone. Mary, still at the farm working on the chores, decides to call Ross. Ross is Josiah's brother. She told him she saw them come home last night because they had a special Children's Day show at the church that Sarah was leading. All the Moore children participated along with Ina May and Lena Stillinger. Lena was 12 and Ina May was 8. They were both members of the Presbyterian Church and the Junior Society. They participated with the Moore children in the Children's Day activities. Lena and Ina May asked if they could go home with the Moores because they were close friends with Catherine. Their parents would soon wish that they would have said no. Ross, Josiah's brother, was kind of worried because it wasn't like the family to not be up and about. Josiah hadn't even shown up to work. Ross got to the house, and he just happened to have a key.
What?
Ross.
Why would he have a key?
He's Josiah's brother. Just a spare key. Okay. I guess they did stuff like that. Ross goes in, but Mary decides to stay outside. She's still kind of creeped out a little bit, and she feels like there's something bad that happened. The first thing he notices is every window is covered. The house is pitch black because there are extra coverings on the windows. Ross went in the bedroom downstairs and smelled death. He saw two little bodies covered in blankets, and they were laying in pools of blood. Mm-hmm. Blood was everywhere. He ran outside and told Mary, quote, "Something terrible has happened." They called the police. They showed up and opened the makeshift curtains. Blood was all over the house. They found the axe in the downstairs bedroom, leaning against the wall. It was bloody with hair and pieces of flesh on it. Some people believe he waited in the house until the family fell asleep. Hank Horton, the officer, walks upstairs after seeing the downstairs bedroom. He went into Josiah and Sarah's room. Same thing. Blood was everywhere. They were covered with blankets. When they uncovered them, their heads were literally crushed in. Josiah received more blows than anyone. His face was hit so many times, both of his eyes were missing. Also,
it's like Walking Dead crap.
It really is. But also, the killer, and just remember this, guys, because it comes back. He used the blunt end of the axe, not the sharp end.
Do what? That would be difficult.
Yeah, like, he had to be in shape, too.
Because the weight of it alone, trying to swing that is...
Yeah. Yeah, he used the blunt end, and he had to do it to 8 people. Was it 8?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the ceiling actually had gashes in it from the axe, and then he went to the next bedroom, and all the children were dead and blood...
Huh? How'd the ceiling have gashes in it from the axe if he uses the other end?
From the upswing, like when he brought it up and then went down.
But if he was using the other end, it wouldn't have happened that way.
Well, somehow it did.
You know, you see what I'm saying though?
I see what you're saying. And somehow it happened. But yeah, it's one of the main things in the story. And like I said, it comes back as him using the blunt end of the axe. I don't know why you would do that. I feel like it would get it over with faster.
Yeah, it would take a while with the other end because the weight of it alone. I mean, imagine holding it at the bottom where the blade is, like right above it.
Yeah.
And then trying to swing it that way, it's just...
But then once you got it up in the downswing, it would hit with a lot of force, right?
I mean, yeah, if you're swinging hard, but still, it's just, that's weird.
It's very strange. It's not what I would, I mean, if I were an axe murderer, I wouldn't do it that way.
Well, the way I planned your death with it.
The officer went to the next room, and all the children were dead and bludgeoned to death in their beds. After finding all the bodies, Officer Horton comes out and says, quote, "My God, Ross, there's someone murdered in every bed." Now, before...
So did Horton hear who?
Before I go any further, I did mention that he hid lanterns in the house. Now, he did this upstairs and downstairs, and what he did was he split the wick and took the little chimney off of it, so it gave him just enough light to move around the house, but not too much where... somebody could see him coming, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Keep in mind the lights in the town were off, as I said, and the house was total darkness. So I feel like he had been watching this family for a little while. Because how do you not make noise and wake anybody up, you know? Especially with a house full of 6 kids. You know something had to be laying in the floor, right? So... word is spreading now around the town what's going on. Sarah Stillinger is still trying to get a hold of the Moores to see when she can get her daughters back. She decided to call again. And keep in mind, y'all, back then when they did make a phone call, they had to go through an operator. So you would have to call the operator and say, I need to be connected to this house or this family or whatever, and they would connect you to that family. You would talk to them. So the operators would sometimes stay on the line. You know, they knew everything going on in that town pretty much, which would be a freaking awesome job to have. Wow. You know it? So anyway, she calls the operator and she asked, you know, could I please be connected to the Moore house? And as soon as she said that, the operator replied with, everyone in that house is dead.
Yeah.
So they finally got the doctors to arrive. They start in the room with the Stillinger girls. Anna Mae was killed first, and Lena was after Anna Mae. Lena was the last person in the house to be killed. She was laying in a different position.
You know, that also, too, makes you wonder, like, did it say who, in which order they were killed? Did they know?
Yeah.
Were the kids last or first?
They killed the parents first.
And
so,
see that, you can just imagine being a little kid and seeing that, knowing what's coming. And how's,
they didn't, though. But that's why they killed the parents first, so the kids were, like, easy pickings, because they didn't wake up. Like, when they saw the kids, it's very awful. But when they saw the kids, it looked like the kids were laying how they were sleeping, like, which, you know, it's an awful thing, but at least there's that. You know, maybe they died instantly from the blood. And these were young kids, so it would not take much, you know. But as I was saying, Lena was the last one to get killed. She was laying in a different position. But it is believed that Lena woke up and fought back. She was 12 years old. She had defensive marks on her arms. Her nightgown was pulled up above her waist and her underwear was removed. Lena was a victim of some kind of sexual assault and they don't know exactly what happened to her. Josiah Moore had the most damage. They were all hit 20 to 30 times in the face, but the killer actually went back and hit Josiah some more after he finished up with everybody else.
Sounds like this guy, like, hated them.
It does, but after you hear, like, the main suspects, like, they don't have any reason to.
Like, that's just vicious.
It is vicious. So, the more they walked through the house, the weirder things got. They noticed that all the reflective surfaces, like the mirrors and glass, were covered with linens and clothes from the family's drawers. In the kitchen, they found a plate of food, which the killer got him a plate of food after he got done.
You know what this sounds like?
What?
Like that movie Red Dragon.
It does, right?
Like almost exactly,
yeah,
like it.
It really does. Next to the plate of food was a bowl of bloody water that he used to wash his hands in. They noticed, as I said, gouge marks in the ceiling upstairs from the axe's upswing. And he also covered all the victims' faces. There was also a 4-pound slab of bacon laying next to the axe in the downstairs bedroom.
What?
A 4-pound slab of bacon.
What?
Okay. So, the bacon, the police suspect that the killer used the bacon to masturbate to the little girls after he killed them.
Sick fuck.
Yes. But I heard on another podcast, because they had mentioned this also, like, could you imagine being the police officer that figured it out? He was probably like, I bet he used it for this. And all the other officers were like, well, why would you think that? You know? Like,
well, there's no telling after, I mean, this person's obviously deranged and just, ugh, could you imagine?
No, I could not. It's absolutely terrible. The Moore and Stillinger funeral services were held in the Villisca Town Square on June 12th of 1912. There were thousands of people there. The whole town closed down for the day. National Guardsmen blocked the street as the hearse moved towards the firehouse where the 8 victims lay. Their caskets were not on display during the funeral. They were later carried on several wagons to the Villisca Cemetery for burial. and the funeral procession was 50 carriages long.
I would hope so. I mean, that's just, and I'm sure, and this is a little town, right?
Yes, it's a tiny town. So, I mean, just, yeah.
Shocking.
Yes, truly. Lena and Ina May were buried next to each other in the Villisca Cemetery, and I saw a picture, and it's a tombstone, and it's shared by both of them. It has both their names on there, so they're right there with each other, and that actually brought me some kind of comfort when I saw that, that they were pretty much all they had at that time. When that awful tragedy was going on, they had each other, and I'm glad that they still have each other. That's kind of what I thought of it as. And Mary Peckham, the neighbor, died a few months later from the stress of the murder and a broken heart from missing the family so much. So, now, let's go over the suspects.
There's got to be someone that just absolutely hated.
That's the thing, though. You're going to learn that the main suspects really didn't know him that much. But I'm going over all of them, so I'm going to let you decide.
So, when the dude washed his hands, and you said there was a bowl of bloody water found,
mm-hmm.
was there not any, like, DNA evidence from that?
DNA didn't come around until around the 1980s.
Oh.
I believe I could be 100% wrong, but I know they did not have the DNA evidence thing back then in 1912. Because...
You know, you hear about them doing cold cases and how, like, murderers are being freed from prison nowadays because of DNA evidence. I wonder if they ever go back that far to do it.
Well, here's,
or if the stuff would even still be available to do, you know?
Here's the thing. When they were doing the crime scene and the family was still in there, they let people come in the house. Mm. The townspeople wanted to come in the house and see. So the majority of the town walked through everything. And then I heard somewhere that one person even took a piece of Josiah's skull as a keepsake.
What the hell?
Yeah. Like,
remind me to never even drive through that town.
No, this town, it's a wonderful little town. They actually, I'll go over it, but that, I mean, that's definitely fucked what they did, and I hate that. But also, I just don't think they knew how important that stuff was, you know? Like, they wanted to see, like, nosy neighbors and stuff, like, what happened to these people. And
yeah, but that's just sick.
It's very sick. Like, we have so much stuff now where, yeah, that's awful. But they, I mean, it was the early 1900s. They didn't have much,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, but still, there's no way in hell I would take a skull.
I wouldn't do that either. And again...
And plus, as we learned from Supernatural, that skull will have to be salted and burned.
That man was probably haunted after that. But, yes, the suspects. First, we have Frank F. Jones. He was a respected member of the community and an Iowa state senator. Josiah worked for Jones for years and left to start his own company. Now, what they did was, I think they sold and rented out, like, tractor supply stuff. Or farm supplies, pretty much. Now, when Josiah left, though, he took their biggest contract with him to start his own business, which was John Deere. So,
he started John Deere?
He took the contract from John Deere, you know, with him to keep supplying them with stuff. So, it may not have been enough motive for murder, but rumors also flew that Josiah was having an affair with Jones's daughter. Jones was accused, but never had any formal charges. Next, we have...
Well, why would there be charges on an affair?
They're just saying they're trying to look for anybody that would have any kind of motive whatsoever.
Not, I mean, it's morally wrong, but it's not, like, illegal.
But also him taking that huge account with him after he worked under this man for so many years.
Yeah, I get that.
Next, we have William, I think a nickname was Blackie, and his name was Mansfield. Blackie Mansfield was believed to be the murderer because he believed to be responsible for the murder of his wife, his infant child, and his in-laws, as well as similar axe murders committed in Kansas 4 days before the Villisca murders took place. According to Detective Wilson, Blackie was hired by Frank Jones to kill the Moore family. Blackie had an airtight alibi and was released. He then sued Wilkerson and was awarded $2,225. Next, we have Henry Lee Moore, no relation to Josiah. The federal investigator claimed he saw Villisca in 22 other axe murders across the country. Which, that's weird that at that time, that was like a major thing, was axe murders, you know? Because then you have the axe man of New Orleans also that was going on around the same time too.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought that he had done...
I'm sorry.
You're fine.
Was anybody ever arrested for it?
Nope.
So, I mean, it could be just a straggler, something like that, you know?
You're on the right track. He blamed Henry Lee Moore, who, by the way, he had already been convicted for the murder of his mother and grandmother just months before Villisca, and he served 36 years of a life sentence and was paroled in 1949. He was never charged for Villisca or the other 22 murders. Next, we have Andy Sawyer. Andy was a stranger just passing through town. His employer reported him for his odd behavior. Sawyer seemed to be very interested in the murders and slept fully dressed while gripping an axe. The axe he used while working on the Burlington Railroad. He was detained but then let go when they found out he had been arrested for vagrancy in a totally different part of Iowa night of the murders.
What did he do for the railroad?
I don't know.
Because do you know the strength that it takes to hammer down those spikes to make railroads?
I know.
Sorry, I'm just...
No, and I love that you're getting into this because once I tell you the person that just came up in 2017, you're going to be like, bingo.
Well, you see what I'm saying, though.
Like, I see exactly what you're saying, and you are on such the right path. I cannot wait to get to this person. Okay.
It just makes sense with this force to kill them with not using that.
You're absolutely right. You were totally right. So...
Y'all... Hold on. Say that one more time, that last part.
You are totally right.
I never hear that, ever.
Okay, so the next one, this is one of the main suspects, okay? And after I read some stuff, he's got a lot of stuff I'm reading to you. Y'all are going to be like, that's definitely him, okay? But just wait until you hear about the next guy, and then we will talk about that, okay? Next, we have Reverend George Kelly, the main suspect.
Reverend.
Kelly was a traveling reverend. He was in Villisca the night of the murders. He was even at the church event the Moores were at that night. Records show that he left Villisca the next morning at 5:19 a.m., right after the murders were said to have occurred. It was even said he told fellow travelers there were 8 dead souls back in Villisca, butchered in their beds while they slept. The bodies had not been discovered yet.
Well, there you go.
Well, hang on. He even returned 2 weeks later, posing as a detective, and joined a tour of the house with a group of investigators. Now, the people that they talked to were elderly that he told that to. They could not remember the date that he told them that. So it could have been the next day is what they're saying. So they couldn't use that as evidence. Now, him posing as a detective, it reminds me as kind of like killers returning to the scene to see his work, pretty much. Now, I have more on here.
Is that really true or is that just a movie thing?
No, that's really true. They also take trophies. So,
like a skull?
Yeah, but it was proved that he was just mm-hmm. a looky-loo.
I wish they would reopen this case.
Oh, I do too. Shortly after the murder occurred, now we're still on Reverend Kelly, investigators and friends of the family received letters from Kelly, who seemed obsessed with the details of the murder. Kelly's obsessive behavior generated suspicion among investigators, and Kelly soon became a person of interest. Investigators responded to Kelly's letters asking for specific details regarding the crimes. Kelly obliged, stating that he believed he possibly witnessed the murders, described noises he heard, and even describing how the killer was disrupted by a couple walking by the house while the crime was being committed.
Witnessed the murder?
See.
But didn't do anything?
Exactly. Kelly's detailed knowledge of the crime aroused suspicion. Now, I did not write this down because I myself did not read this, but I did hear. Now, when I do research, I listen to all the podcasts and stuff and watch whatever I can about the case. And then I look everything up and try to confirm everything. And then I just kind of put everything together. So I want to get every aspect of it. But I did hear that when he... Okay. When he... Kelly did confess to the crimes. But when he did confess, he said that he killed the children first. And the police knew that wasn't true. So a lot of times in murder cases, people will falsely confess to this. It happens so many times. And I don't know why somebody would do that. But they do. And so the police kind of knew that he was full of it. But we're going to get to it. However, because of Kelly's position in the church and history of mental illness, authorities were skeptical about whether Kelly was in fact responsible, and they didn't take him to custody. He did escape charges for the Villisca murders and was unable to avoid legal trouble later in life. In 1914, he branched out from the preaching profession and began his career as a shorthand reporter. To assist him with his reporting work, Kelly placed an ad in the paper for his secretary. When a young woman responded to the ad, Kelly informed her that the job required her to type in the nude. The woman took Kelly's letter to her pastor, who turned the letter over to the authorities. Kelly was convicted of his crime and later transferred to the Elizabeth Hospital, where he underwent therapy. He then expressed fear that he was going to be arrested for the murders. Now, when he did, I'm going to stop this. When Kelly did confess to the murders, they kept him under investigation for hours upon hours, and he would not confess. So they sent him back to his cell for breaks, I guess. Now, his cellmates, though, were undercover police officers. And they were telling Kelly, they treat you so much better if you just confess. They talked him into confessing. Now, I don't know if they roughed him up while he was under investigation and he wouldn't confess. And then they were like, it'll just stop if you confess, you know?
Yeah, but see, here's the thing, though. It being so horrific.
Yes. Like, I would not.
I wouldn't confess. Like, the bacon and then the child.
Yes.
The, you know.
Exactly.
I would die before I would confess to that.
Exactly. He also allegedly sent a bloody shirt to the cleaners shortly after the murders occurred with no explanation. As I said, he knew specific details with no explanation. And as I said, he did confess. But let me see.
Was he executed?
No. He was an improbable assailant. However, the results of the investigation showed that Kelly was no stranger to nefarious behavior. In addition to seeking to solicit obscene material through the mail, Kelly had a habit of peeping into the windows of homes. In fact, he was caught peering into the window of another woman in Villisca days before the murder. He had also requested multiple girls and young women to pose nude for him on different occasions. despite damning evidence, this was not an open and shut case. A confession is normally a clear indicator of guilt. The circumstances under which the confession was obtained made jurors question its validity. The interrogation of Reverend George Kelly began in the afternoon and continued well into the night. And I went over that. Now, the jurors believed that he was not liable. After deliberation, the jurors in the trial against George Kelly acquitted him of the charges. Where was it, though? I believe he was, though, found guilty for Lena Mueller's murder, though. Or Lena Stillinger, not Mueller. And I don't see how that happens. Like, how can you be charged for one murder and not all of them? Like, he just came in and did that one and let the other person do the rest. You know? Like, why?
So they're saying that it was multiple people?
I don't know. Like, I don't really understand that because it just doesn't make sense to me that...
Well, the whole thing really doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. But... Now, y'all have heard that, and it's awful. Like, it's terrible. So.
I mean, it sounds, I mean, honestly, if I had to pick, I would say the first guy, because he had pure hatred for the guy, the senator dude or whatever.
Yeah.
Because of, I mean, losing money will make you do crazy things, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, the sexual assault and the bacon stuff, that just, I don't know. It takes a special kind of.
Well.
I don't know.
Let me tell you about who they recently came up with. Because, guys, keep in mind, they didn't know what a serial killer was back then. They hadn't coined...
Wait, when was Jack the Ripper?
Jack the Ripper, I don't know, but when I was reading over this, they were saying that they had not coined the phrase serial killer yet. Mm. So... That's where that comes from. And I've got a lot on this guy, too. It just bear with me because this is going to... Y'all are going to be like, actually, no, I think it's this guy. So, in 2017, a book was released called The Man from the Train by Bill James and Rachel McCarthy James. The authors claim they discovered the identity of the Villisca murderer. His name is Paul Mueller, who operated throughout North America and killed between 40 and 100 people. He was an actual serial killer because this crime seemed like a practiced criminal, not just someone off the street coming in. He knew exactly what he was up to, okay? Now, like I said, bear with me. Via research and newspaper archives, the Jameses discovered scores of murders of entire families committed from 1898 to 1912. These crimes occurred in Nova Scotia, Oregon, Kansas, Florida, Arkansas, and other locations, some which they ascribed to Mueller. Though many of these crimes earned significant publicity, they have mostly faded from the attention apart from the Villisca murders. Mueller's name was apparently linked to only one crime in contemporary media. He was the subject of an unsuccessful year-long manhunt as the sole suspect in an 1897 murder of a family near West Brookfield, Massachusetts, who had employed him as a farmhand. According to Rachel McCarthy James, she and her father unearthed probably 500 words of material about Mueller, specifically his physical appearance, where he's from, his skills, and his family. Mueller was 35 years old in 1897, claimed to be a German military veteran, and was known as a skilled carpenter who spoke very little English. He was described as a short, muscular man in stature with unusually small and widely spaced teeth. He is believed to most likely worked as a lumberjack.
Mm.
Given his woodworking skills, the killer's use of an axe, and the fact that most of the murders occurred in or near logging areas. The Jameses point out that in these times, local police usually assumed a local murderer with some connection to the victims. The concept of a nationwide traveling serial killer was never even considered in most cases, and this led to a serial murderer possibly being missed. Police investigative methods and technology were very primitive compared to a few decades later. They couldn't do fingerprints or blood typing, and crime scenes were compromised. Let's see. According to the Jameses, a number of murders in the period which were assumed by local police to be one-off incidents were actually committed by a single person, probably Mueller, based on certain similarities among these crimes. Okay, y'all listen. The similarities in all these crimes included the scene being within a few hundred feet of a railroad junction, the slaughter of entire families in small towns with little or no police force, the families having a barn where the killer was believed to have hidden to observe the families having no dog to warn off an intruder, the killer using the blunt edge of an axe as a murder weapon, the killer leaving the axe in plain sight, and the killer covering the victims with sheets or blankets prior to the murders. The killer covering the windows from the inside of the house with sheets or towels in the absence of robbery. The killer's primary motive is believed to have been a sadistic sexual attraction to prepubescent girls, factoring in a majority of the killings. While adults were ambushed and murdered in bed while sleeping, girls often showed defense wounds or other evidence of struggle. Media reports of the crimes often included veiled references to the killer having ejaculated at the crime scene or having molested the girls after death. The presence of a slab of bacon at the Villisca scene, possibly used as a masturbation aid, may bolster this theory, according to the authors. What do you think?
I honestly don't know.
There was a serial murderer going around doing this to many families.
Same way?
Same exact way. Blunt edge of the axe, killing the parents first, covering the windows and anything made of glass, covering the victims up.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously then. I mean, it's that.
So,
too many coincidences.
There's a ton. So, let's see.
But there, I don't know why someone would confess, you know, to something like that.
A lot of people do. It's so weird. They noted that that nationwide from 1890 to 1912, there was an average of 8 murdered families per year. Let's see. Most of which do not share the characteristics reported in the media for crimes attributed to Mueller. And that was all I had. So, we have the Reverend and Mueller. So, which one?
I'm not going to go with the Reverend now.
Yeah, see, like,
it just makes more sense. I mean, yeah. Someone else is doing exactly that.
Exactly.
You know, unless he heard about it and was like, hey, you know what? That sounds like a good idea.
A copycat.
Yeah.
And he had a history of mental illness. So, it is very difficult. Now, we are running short on time, so I'm going to go over the paranormal part of it really fast, and then we'll see y'all next Sunday. So, Darwin and Martha Lynn bought the house and planned on turning it into a historical museum, a place to honor the family and pay respect. They even decorated the house how it would have looked in 1912. And I love that. They were such patriots for their town, and they think that people should remember it, you know?
I think so, too.
I think it's wonderful what they did. Now, as soon as they did, the paranormal investigators started showing up. They had never even heard the word paranormal, but they did know something was off about the house. So today, the Villisca Axe Murder House serves as a paranormal hotel.
So you can go and stay there and all that stuff.
You can pay $428 to book an overnight stay. Martha will meet up with you and hand over the keys and meet you in the morning. And you even get pizza and bottled water.
Where is this at again?
It's in Iowa. And you also, they also have daytime tours, and they're only $10 per person. I think $5 if you're under 12.
That's just such a horrific event that I don't know. Truly. I want to see something like that.
Well,
I mean, murder is one thing, but to, I don't know, to be so cruel.
Right.
You know.
Martha Lynn, the current owner, has been quoted saying, "I feel like there's something there. If indeed there are spirits, you have to realize six of them are children. I don't know if the murderers still exist there, but there have been a few things that have happened that aren't exactly calming, but I don't like to dwell on it." Now, everything I saw, everyone that had done the whole investigation thing, they said it was a negative energy that they felt. It was not children, like playful energy. It was negative. Now, many people leave toys for the children that come and visit. People have heard disembodied laughter and children's voices play over the last night of the lives of the kids like a record. Some have heard screams and unexplained movement, and signs of possession also have occurred. Let's see. In 2014, a man was ghost hunting in the house for the night. He said he went in the kid's bedroom and was shouting at the ghost, trying to get some kind of activity, and the next thing he knew, he woke up in the emergency room. He had stabbed himself in the chest. He had no memory of it whatsoever, and a few years later, he went back to apologize to the spirits. Now, I mentioned, well, I'm about to mention, sorry. When the train passes through the town at the time of the murders, it, you know, because it's a train town, a strange fog will move through each of the bedrooms.
Oh, hell.
Yeah. which makes me think the murder could be residual, meaning it's being reenacted each night. I also
by the
heard...
the person who worked on the railroad?
See, I don't... It's weird, right? children are drawn to Lena and Ina May's room. Ina May. They will start talking to something that isn't there. And one child started looking under the sheets on the bed playing peekaboo. So.
And you know, those are going to be like, if it really is like haunted, that's going to be some vengeful spirits.
Well, the kids, from what I understand, they play, they get all, they've got a bunch of toys in there because people love bringing toys. Like every now and then somebody will just see a ball roll across the floor. Like they're playful, they're still kids. They want to play and be kids. But it sounds to me like with them saying they hear the same thing over and over, this sounds residual. That, as I said, they act out the murder each night. It just keeps going on and on and on. So I don't know. I've never been to the house. I've never personally spoken to anyone that has been to the house. So it may not be, but that's, I mean, it kind of sounds like that to me, but I hope it's not. I hope they don't have to relive that out for eternity, because that is just awful for some precious little babies to have to do that.
I'm telling you, salt and burn the skull.
But that is the story of the Villisca Axe Murders.
Very sad story.
A very sad story. And I was going over it, and it was just me at the house when I was going over it. I got really spooked when I was. This story really spooks me out. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I spent a lot of time on this story just because I feel like the victims deserve it. You know, people need to know their story.
Yep.
And I hope you guys not really enjoyed it, but maybe learned something. But thank you guys for listening. We will see you guys on Sunday. Can I say you guys some more?
Yeah, right.
But we will have another wonderful, scary story for you next time. Do you have anything you want to say?
No, not really.
You good?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, y'all. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight, and we will see y'all next Sunday. Stay hydrated and make good choices. Bye, guys.
Bye.